This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
Let's do it. Mr. Jeff.
Hi, thank you.
Today we're conducting some very important research.
Hopefully nobody comes in here and murders anyone while we're here doing this.
Executive producer Danny and I are at the Brisbane Hotel for a knockoff drink.
Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Palmy cheers.
Palmy cheers. Oh no, flying cheers.
Located on the corner of Brisbane and Beaufort Street, the Brisbane Hotel has been trading for over a century. The popular pub and significant landmark has been refurbished in recent years. It looks modern and on a Friday is buzzing with people clocking off from a week of hard yakka.
Yeah.
How good's that?
I'd murder someone for that.
Are you a bit of a palmy connoisseur? Do you have like a chips underneath rule?
No. In fact, I find it best not to have rules when it comes to things like palmy.
Okay.
You know?
I respect that.
But oh, if these walls could talk. Perth has a long history of dodgy pubs, and the Brisbane Hotel is no exception.
Yeah, it was after one of his escapes, one of his first escapes, he just said that, I'm so sorry for Marks, but I was doped with the grog. Tell the police to not think too bad of me.
On Saturday, March 10, 1928, Edward Nicholas Kelly shot dead Sergeant Mark after a big night at the pub. Kelly had been refused drinks after a long night of drinking and left the premises only to return and threaten to shoot up the servers. What followed made for a sensational story for the local media. Today on the podcast, we're spending time with historian Eddie Marcus to unpack the events of March 10, 1928, and chat about dodgy pubs in Perth. Perth is one of the most isolated cities in the world. So far removed from the rest of the globe, it might as well be its own planet. Join me, Jeff Bullen, as I take a deep dive into the weird, wacky, and unexplained history of our eccentric city, digging up memories of bygone icons, personalities, and events. This is Planet Perth.
Well, my name's Eddie, and I have on my business card that I'm a professional historian, which sounds great. The next question people ask is, can you actually be paid for that? The answer is nowhere near enough. Mostly what I do is I work for local government and state government for contracts to do heritage work. So if you want to redevelop an old place into a bar, and then you need to know which bits can be kept for planning purposes, I'm the person who can make a report that says they should keep this bit and this bit can go.
Sweet. Good person to have on side. Now, Eddie, you enjoy the dodgy side of Perth history. Could you set the scene of what Perth nightlife was like in the late 1920s?
It probably wasn't that great in terms of, nightclubs. There were a few dance halls. I think by that stage, what is now the Rechabite Hall, or was the Rechabite Hall then, had long since been dropped its anti-alcohol use, which is what it was set up to do, to be a teetotal place.
Teetotalers Hall.
And had been taken over into dancing. So young people were certainly, teenagers were not quite there yet. That wasn't to come till the 40s or 50s, this idea of the teenager. But young people certainly went out for a dance, and that could either be in local halls, the local council halls, or sometimes private venues. So there were a couple on Beaufort Street. There's one up my end in Inglewood that was called Riley's Hall, and that was just a private hall. A speculator built it, and if you wanted to hire it for the weekend, for your 21st or for a dance on a Saturday night, it was available.
They weren't totally conservative, country folk, all of them back then. I mean, we had flappers and, people that are really exploring the fashion back then.
We did. I mean, it's a town. It's like any town. It would have some conservative people. It still does today. and there was always young people looking for a good time.
So what draws you most to these stories?
There's two things I think that draws most of the stories. First of all, I love debunking the idea that things were better in the past. You know, the people who try to tell you there was no crime in Perth in the 1950s and we could leave our doors open. Well, apart from the serial killers, that is. So I don't recommend leaving your doors open in the 1950s in Perth.
There was still theft.
But every generation believes this. You know, the people in the 1980s said that the 1950s could leave the door open. I've heard people today claiming it in the 1980s and 90s you could leave your door open in Perth. So it's just, I like debunking the idea that, you know, everything is so much better in the past. I also like pointing out that the foibles of the older generation, so the same as our generations, they're not any different, but they also had sex. They also drank too much. They also fought on the beaches, and not in a good military way, but just punching on in the beaches.
Right.
And so there's that. So that's, you know, and people often surprised because people think, well, the past must be different. And the past is different. They are not exactly the same as us. But in some ways, of course, human beings are human beings. And they have the same passions and the same likes and the same dislikes. And so it's that combination of what's different, what stays the same. And if you can do it with a bit of sex, drugs and rock and roll, you can engage an audience.
Well, looking at this Brisbane Hotel shooting, when you first discovered this story, what was your reaction? Had you previously been to the Brisbane Hotel?
I've been to the Brisbane Hotel since it's been redeveloped. I don't recall, as I was saying off air before we started, I don't recall if I ever had a drink there. If I did, I must have been very drunk and not remember yeah. being there. Apparently, by the time, but just before it was redeveloped, it was a really run-down place with skimpies and apparently less clothing than your average skimpy is the story that's often told. I would remember that, I think, had I been
there. Was a very dark and seedy hotel.
And not very well used. So the current owners took it over and, of course, did a lovely job with the extension into the beer garden. And it is one of the finest beer gardens in the metropolitan area. Hot summer's day, go there, get a bottle of wine, sit there all afternoon, and it's a great way of spending time. That's not just an advert. I am not paid by the Brisbane Hotel.
No, it is just a recommendation. Very cool, shady corners on the outside, and in wintertime, those fireplaces are quite delightful.
They are indeed. It's a place I go to. It's got good food, it's got good beers, little pricey beers, but beers. No, see, that's why you know I'm not paid by the Brisbane Hotel.
But we're more than happy to take a beer from the Brisbane Hotel if they're willing to offer. Now, let's have a little bit of a look at Edward Kelly's actions. Could you walk us through Edward Kelly's actions the night of the 8th of March, 1928?
Well, let's step back a little and just ask, first of all, who is this?
Who Edward? Is this man? Who is this Edward Kelly?
So he's often in more modern tellings of this described as Ned Kelly. I can find only one reference to him being called Ned Kelly. He is of Irish descent. He is an American, probably from New York or Boston. It's not clear. So he's an Irish-American. He was in the Merchant Navy, and presumably that's how he ended up in Perth, having either jumped ship.
Was that a common thing back then for somebody to, well, be just emigrating around the world at leisure?
We have quite
a distance to cover, isn't it?
It is, but we have a number of Americans, not a huge amount of Americans, but Americans who either just settled in Perth or jumped ship and stayed here. Some very early ones of African Americans who, you know, jumped ship and stayed in down Rockingham way. That's a story from an entirely different day. And then they married into the local Aboriginal mobs.
Oh, wow. How difficult it would have been as an African-American coming to racist old Perth.
Well, they married into the local Aboriginal mobs down there. So there are Aboriginal people from the Rockingham area, or at least were originally 200 years ago nearly now in the Rockingham area, who are descended from both African-Americans and their Aboriginal ancestors, which, again, that's another story for another day.
That is another story for another day we're going to be planet Perthing on. That's for certain.
So Kelly.
Edward Kelly, is it?
We know quite a bit about him because there was a police report put out because they wanted to apprehend him. So we know he was 5'7", with grey hair, almost bald. We know that. Wild-looking blue eyes. Which is
wild-looking blue eyes.
Wild-looking blue eyes. We'll get into his mental health a little later. A prominent nose and a dark complexion. He has a noticeable scar on the first finger of his left hand and an ink mark on the third.
An ink mark.
I think they might mean birthmark.
Birthmark. I was going to say, because that ink, it's not really a permanent.
Well, we'll get to the ink now, because having been in the Navy, he was extensively tattooed.
Uh-huh.
Now, his visible tattoos were the back of his left hand, had a vase, a rose, a bracelet, and a sword. On his left arm was a sailor dancing on a rum cask. And his right arm had the figure of a girl. I assume one of those hula girls, you know, that was the standard,
yep.
You know, 19th century and even early 20th century sailor-y tattoo. Also had a butterfly, a bracelet, and what they just say is a spray, which I take to be in a bunch of flowers. So we have this 5'7". He's also described as heavy. He was 13 stone or 82 kilograms in our modern speak. So that's not as heavy as I would like to think, because I'm a lot more than that. But, so he was 5'7", stocky, ex-Navy, heavily tattooed. You'd have thought he'd be spottable, you know, on the streets.
You'd think he'd stand out.
You'd think he would. So he had been in trouble with the cops before the events of 1927. He'd threatened someone with a pistol that he had purchased just hours before, about in 1921, I think it was. And so for that, he'd got fined because he hadn't actually discharged the pistol. So he was just fined, you know, for causing a nuisance in public.
Do we know why he was threatening somebody with a pistol?
We don't. Unfortunately, the news story, it seems to be that, you know, they had known each other and had fallen out. There was nothing more. The courts didn't seem to, if it was discussed in court, it didn't seem relevant. I imagine it was a very quick magistrate's, you know, hearing, just bang, bang, through here. £1 fine, on your way, Sonny.
Yep.
But then in 1922, 23, about a year after this, he was caught having broken in to a bookshop in Perth. And for that, he was sentenced to 5 years. So he had been in prison for most of the time before the events we are about to have unfold now.
I tell you what, 5 years is a fairly long stretch for breaking into a bookshop.
It was basically the three strikes and you're out principle. He was a well-known to the cops for various petty things, and this time the magistrate was going, "They've had enough with you. You're off for 5 years." Maybe on appeal he might have got away with it, but there was hardly any such thing as an appeal in those days.
It was into Fremantle prison you go.
Planet Perth.
So that would have been, 5 years. And so he hadn't been out that long before the events of 1927 that we're now going to discuss, which is the point of today's topic.
Which makes it very interesting that Edward Kelly was able to get himself out of jail and buy a gun.
he hadn't got the gun at the start of our story. He had gone to the Brisbane Hotel to drink. He wasn't well known there, apparently. They didn't recognise him, which is hardly surprising given he'd been in prison for 5 years. He wasn't a regular.
Been out of circulation.
Wasn't a regular in the Brisbane. So he kept demanding drinks, and at one point he tried to sneak off into the kitchen to talk to the waitresses, and the barman was having none of this and told him that any more of that and you're out. He was then eventually refused service. You know, cut off.
Yes.
From there.
As we do.
He then tried to sneak round to the other bar in the same place and was cut off again. At this point, he seems to have made various threats that he would go get a gun and shoot the place up. They didn't actually take him seriously, but just in case, they did call the police. And an off-duty copper was sent round, basically, to just sit there just to make sure that nothing happened. And from there, we do know quite a bit because of the court case that would come up. Kelly went into town and went to 331 Wellington Street, a building which, whilst doesn't survive intact, survives as a facade. And most people will notice the old Army store on the corner of Pier Street and Wellington Street. Then it was a second-hand dealer of Ernest Ruttle, and maybe a bit later we'll discuss Ernest Ruttle a little more, because he's not a great character either. So this man, who was drunk enough to be refused service, wasn't apparently drunk enough to be sold a pistol and the ammunition to go with it. I say Ernest Ruttle was not the good guy in this story. And in fact, Kelly, in his court case, tried to blame Ruttle and claimed that he should be up there in court as well
for selling
him the gun in the first place. So an interesting defence that I don't think was followed up in law. So he then walked along Wellington Street, just meandering, and then, for no reason at all, as far as we can determine, shot out the window of a fast food place. A fast food place with a lovely name of Happy Jack's. So close to Hungry Jack's. But yes, that strangely doesn't seem to have got the cops flying down to arrest a man who's shooting up windows in Wellington Street. There, he then went to a tobacconist and sat in a chair and lit a cigarette, which... It's not clear to me whether or not you're allowed to smoke in a tobacconist in 1927, but one presume it's not the normal thing to...
I would have thought you could smoke anywhere in 1927. Well, you could smoke riding your horse.
In the good old days, before I gave up smoking, you could smoke anywhere here. It would be lovely. I miss smoking. There were later reports that he had a smouldering gun on his lap, but this turns out to be, exaggerated. Mm. He was just there.
Well, if it was still smouldering, it'd be rather uncomfortable sitting on one's lap. A little bit warm.
I would imagine so. So he then goes down Pier Street, where he vanishes, and the next time we hear of him, he's got a taxi back to the Brisbane. And so we have this man who's threatened to shoot up the place. He's got himself a gun. He's already demonstrated a willingness to use it by shooting out the window of a fast food establishment. And he's now got a taxi all the way back to the Brisbane Hotel. It's not a long walk, by the way. I'm not quite sure what he did in the taxi.
I was going to say, he's taken quite a circuitous route.
I don't think it's to evade people, but perhaps there was just a taxi, there, so he
jumped in, and away we go.
The taxi. It's not clear why he took a taxi, but he took a taxi. So he then enters, and at this point, he seems to have pulled out the revolver. And his first shot, he fires, basically grazes the barman, but shatters the mirror. That sort of mirror, behind the bar where you have your spirits and things. The next one is put into the ceiling. At this point, our off-duty copper, Sergeant Alexander Marks, attempts to take him down. And in the struggle, Sergeant Marks is shot.
So Sergeant Marks is just hanging out having a beer post-work,
he deliberately, because of they'd been asked, the cops had been asked to send someone. So Marks, being off duty, went, I'll go there. They had not taken it seriously. They did not believe this bloke was really going to come back with a gun at this time. So Marks is shot, but he still, despite being shot, manages to hold on to his man, along with the assistance of another patron there, and they wrestle him to the ground when the on-duty cops arrive and take him away. At this point, Sergeant Marks is transferred to what was later RPH, just then Perth Hospital, where he is in a critical condition because the bullet has penetrated right down his stomach at a lower angle. It's not a clean wound at all. And he does actually die 2 or 3 days later, meaning that it's a murder case now.
And not just any murder. It's a murder of a police officer. That makes things pretty serious back in those days.
It makes it pretty serious today. Courts do not take kindly to cop murders. There is, of course, a question which was hardly discussed in the court case as to whether this was a murder. The only person who brought it up was Mr. Kelly himself on the stand, whether or not a struggle in which a weapon is discharged can be murder. He didn't deny shooting.
Yes.
But he denied
willful
murder. So he would have been asking for manslaughter, in effect, a reckless act, rather than an intentional shooting.
Went there to fire a bullet into this man's stomach.
Nonetheless, the newspapers were very uninterested and just described him as a police killer, a police murderer, which, to be fair, he was shooting off a gun, recklessly in a bar, and a cop tried to stop him and got shot. So it's quite close to killing a police officer.
And on the given day, it could have been more than just that one police officer. It could have been some patrons in Happy Jacks.
It certainly could have been.
Sorry to infringe there on the naming.
He was then taken to court, obviously. By which initially tried with wounding a police officer, but very quickly the charge upgraded.
48 hours later.
Our court courses in those days were much, much quicker. It would have been mere weeks to months at top. Nowadays, you know, people can commit a murder and you won't hear the trial for 5 odd years later down. Never understand how slowly our justice system grinds nowadays. But in those days, the trial would have been weeks to months.
Wow.
To tops afterwards. So it was pretty bang, bang, bang.
The habeas corpus was more of a thing back in those days.
And what was clear from Kelly on the stand was that he was not mentally well. He did a lot of his own defence, which is never a good idea, but he was ranting.
Well, my heart did not will murder, but my mad brain did.
Yeah, not everyone was convinced. There were differing opinions from psychologists, because obviously he was found guilty and therefore sentenced to death, but the death sentence can be commuted because criminally insane, you know.
Right.
There was no not guilty. Nowadays, you can actually get a not guilty by reason of insanity, right, or not even fit to stand trial by reason of insanity today. In those days, it was basically a mitigating circumstance. You would be found guilty of the murder, and then by reason of your insanity, you would not serve it in the jail, you would serve it in Claremont Insane Asylum. Greylands, as it is now.
But what were things like at Claremont back in the day, or Greylands? Was that a worse sentence than prison?
Well, the fact
because I mean, Fremantle Prison wasn't too attractive either.
No, but the fact that he managed to escape twice suggests that the security levels at Claremont were not necessarily the same as the security levels. Very few asylums have ever been places you would want to go. I did quite a lot of research, again, for a government report, into what is now the Fremantle Arts Centre.
Right, yeah.
The old Fremantle Asylum. And conditions there were never good. I mean, there used to be regular inspections, as there are for public health reasons, and it was rarely reported that it was a good place to be. Stories from people who were held in Fremantle, I haven't actually got identical stories, but I imagine it would be similar in Claremont, was that just some people's mental illness meant they screamed all night, and there'll be six to a ward, you know, and you would be there held there for months with somebody screaming continuously. The standards of hygiene weren't great, you know, amongst this, and the staff were basically not trained. There would be a nurse or a few nurses, but for the most part, the staff were orderlies, you know, untrained orderlies. I don't want to insult any modern orderly with their high level of training and skill. But in those days, an orderly was just, you know, a worker with little skills. And their job was to be big and, if need be, use force to move people.
I guess what I'm angling at is that it certainly wasn't a great fallback position for Ed to get into.
No death, though. Was the other option was not jail for him. The other option was hanging.
Yeah.
So in that case, given the choice was hanging or going into the asylum, maybe you'd have taken
I'll
asylum.
I'll take option B. Yeah. So the media played a large part in the lead up to the case.
Absolutely.
They really hooked into him.
This is one of the weird things about Australian culture. And we'll go back to the original Ned Kelly for this, which was almost exactly 50 years to the day prior to this. Ned Kelly has supporters. He was another cop killer, but he had his supporters because he played up, and the whole Kelly gang, if you use the language that people normally use, played up the oppressed Irish citizens against this elite English system that was oppressing them. So the cop who was killed, or the cops that were killed by the Kellys, didn't represent, you know, hard-working men with families. They represented an evil system. And yes, and the media absolutely played this up, to the disgust, by the way, of course, of the police force out there. And to the disgust of many of the politicians, although some politicians campaigned for this, the original Ned Kelly, to have his sentence commuted. He really, really got the public's backing on this one, which is you'd think slightly weird, but it has to put into that context of he orchestrated quite brilliantly a campaign to have him seen as an oppressed artist. And in some ways, you think about it, the Ned Kelly story seems slightly romantic with his, you know, homemade armor and things, all those Sidney Nolan paintings that you can go and see. You know, he's not portrayed by Sidney Nolan as a cop killer.
Certainly not, no.
He's portrayed as some sort of figure on the landscape, you know, something heroic. Admittedly, something mythical. Sidney Nolan paintings are a little more complicated than just celebrating, you know, Ned Kelly. But he's certainly not portrayed as an evil cop killer.
The word bush ranger is a lot far removed from a cop killer.
So I would suggest that partly it's our own man's name, the Edward Kelly we're talking about. Although I say I can't find him ever called Ned Kelly, except for a couple of references early on, prior to this story, but earlier incidents he'd had when they went, we have our own Ned Kelly in town.
Gotcha.
But I think there's a possibility that aided the romanticism a little. But again, we still have this, especially after his escapes there. He was now seen as, you know, something of maybe a tragic heroic figure, certainly not somebody you'd want to hang around with because he had severe mental illness and was violent.
Clearly.
But, you know, again, a man who beats the system is a figure that can be heroicized, I'm thinking that's a real word, made a hero, and at least by the media and by the public. And so, yeah, he was, despite being literally a criminal lunatic, had something of a figure. And they liked it. The media obviously likes these things because it's different. The public gets to have somebody who's kicking back at the system. And the stories, so in his first escape, he writes a letter claiming that he'd gone down to the Claremont Royal Show dressed as a woman and spent the day there dressed as an old woman enjoying himself. And again, this is, you know, he said there were cops all over the place and not one recognized me. He said that one might have, but he looked at my feet and they seemed too big for a woman's, but he might have thought I was a pommy. I have no idea what he means by that, speaking as an Englishman myself.
Yes.
Do we have big feet by tradition? I don't know. But so
good, you know, reputation to have.
So he's playing up this, you know, escape, disguise, you know. Is it true? We don't know if it's true. We don't know if he really spent the day at the Royal Show disguised as an old woman. What we have is a letter from him to the Mirror, the newspaper of the time, saying that he spent the day at the Royal Show.
And they lapped it up.
Absolutely. And he regularly, I mean, he agreed to meet with the Mirror photographer for his return to the asylum, voluntary return, on condition, you know, that he was shot in a favourable pose, basically. And, of course, the Mirror was never going to damn this man who's arranged an exclusive story for the Mirror.
Yeah, crazy like a fox.
Planet Perth.
Hey, it's Jeff here. I just wanted to take a moment out from chatting with Eddie to let you know of another great podcast here on The Sound Alternative. It's called Sovereign, and it's a fortnightly podcast by sister girls Charlene Ballack and IG McKenna about First Nations affairs, fashion, relationships, and everything else in between. Go on, subscribe now on iTunes and Spotify, or visit RTRFM's brand spanking new website to stream for free. All right, now back to the pub.
Planet Perth.
So, take us through the trial. Was there, obviously, there was not much doubt about who'd committed the crime here. So the verdict was pretty quick.
The trial was not, in one sense, particularly interesting as a trial because, as you say, it's a foregone conclusion. Kelly had the gun. Kelly discharged the gun. The cop was shot with Kelly's gun. He tried. So, I mean, if I give you a quote, on the stand, he said he'd been in and out of mental hospitals all his life, and he'd only just got out of Fremantle Jail before hitting Brisbane. So he tried to use that to, you know, to emphasise that he's not bad, he's
crazy.
Mad. So he stands on the stand. He gets up on the stand and says, I wish to discuss the difference between willful murder and otherwise, and I wish to show the absurdity of a charge of willful murder being laid against me. I turned my revolver to the glass to frighten the barman. Instead of the barman, I accidentally killed Sergeant Mark. I was apprehended by him and others, and in the struggle the revolver went off. I cannot see why I should be charged with willful murder. It was unforeseen, an accident in the struggle. I had never seen Mark until I went to the hospital, and I put up my hand and said, Mr. Mark, I am sorry for you. I did not mean to kill you. I will never forget the face of Sergeant Mark. If it is the pleasure of my countrymen to allow me to live any longer. Motive was there none. If a man is to be convicted of willful murder, there must be a motive. He then pointed to his own head and said, there is something radically wrong up here. Now, see, it's not stark raving. This is not word salad. This is a coherence, at least as reported by the media, remember.
Is this in front of a judge or a jury?
Yes, a judge and jury.
Judge and jury?
Jury. So I think it's a little unlikely he was taken to the hospital, unless it was for some identification purposes that Mark, just the sergeant, critically ill, just had to say, that is the man who shot me, you know, for some legal reasons. Because that's the only time that's ever brought up. At all. Right. But it does say, it's quite specifically, that he was the first time he ever saw his face, was going to, you know, the hospital and apologising to him. So maybe he was for some legal reasons, you know, so the officer could identify the... Definitely.
Yeah.
But, you see, And that's really what most of the trial centred around, from Kelly's perspective, was... Can you charge somebody with murder who, one, didn't intend to kill anyone, and two, there was no question. I really don't think there was a question to the modern reader's idea that this was not murder. Maybe some lawyer would disagree, you know, that if you're reckless enough, it does escalate. But to the modern reader, you're looking at somebody who is drunk, mentally ill, shooting off, and this goes, the gun goes off in the struggle with the police officer, he's not shot at a distance. So today we would see that, I think, very much in terms of, you know, manslaughter or whatever the legal side is. I am not a lawyer, so I'm not going to be certain on any of that. But he was sentenced to death. And this is, but then, as would happen largely today, psychiatric reports.
So he was found guilty.
Found guilty.
Found guilty, and a first-degree murder, or whatever they would call
murder.
It.
I think just murder. Willful murder. Murder,
we call it here. So then it's up to the judge to consider mitigating circumstances?
It is. I think, again, there's some technical aspects of 1920s law that I am certainly not going to be an expert on. But I think, basically, the execution is the default sentence for willful murder. And then, yes, the judge can then look at whether there's any grounds for clemency after that. And in this case, apparently, there was more than one report and they disagreed. At least one report said he was not mentally ill enough to evade justice. Other report or reports, we don't have access to this. I mean, these reports may be buried somewhere in archival files. I've certainly not.
Certainly when you look at his courtroom performance, there would have been some doubt in people's minds. I mean, given that he was up there for a half-hour speech, effectively.
I mean, he can certainly speak coherently, but that's not the only sign of mental illness, of course. I mean, there are others. And he had, as by his own admission, been in and out of mental asylums his whole life. And it seems that drinking triggered violence almost automatically in him. There's a reference in a letter that he wrote. You know, you might want to take it with a pinch of salt since he's trying to self-plead, you know, for his own case, but he blames the grog, you know, for triggering the mentals. Not that he got drunk and that's what did it, but his brain didn't deal well with the booze. So, yeah, it was after one of his first escapes, he just said that, you know, I'm so sorry for Marks, but I was doped with the grog. Tell the police to not think too bad of me. An unlikely outcome.
Yeah, I'm sure there's been many a criminal would like to pin the entirety of their crime on that, on the grog, on the crack, on the...
Well, they do, and sometimes, you know, it is accepted, and sometimes it's not accepted. I think it's very much a case-by-case basis. This one's an interesting case, but of course we don't have him. I mean, he died in 1957 in Claremont Asylum. He never he escaped briefly twice, but he did end his life.
How was mental health viewed in the 1920s in Perth? I mean, did that actually have an impact on his trial, our perception of mental illness?
That's a very deep question and one I'm not competent to give you a very good answer to. Mental illness was very much seen still as something you kept people away from society if you were strongly enough mental ill. If you've had enough level of mental illness, you went to an asylum. There was no care in the community. And there were certainly no drugs on offer in those days to deal with it, other than, you know, sedatives to knock somebody out if they're being too violent. So very much mental illness was seen. It's a very complicated thing. Slightly earlier, it was seen largely in conjunction with being bad, not quite you deserve the mental illness, but what's the difference between somebody being mentally ill and doing something bad and just being bad? The law had a distinction, but didn't mean always people.
Exactly.
Had that distinction.
Well, and it's how the media is going to frame it as well.
Yeah. So very much most famously, I wish I could remember her name, the lass who in the ballroom shot her ex-lover.
Audrey Jacob.
That's the one. And she also, of course, pleaded that temporary insanity due to... Now, there are many modern commentators who believe that she was very compos mentis, but she threw herself on the mercy of the courts, and those eyes, which is all the newspapers banged on about in the day, was Audrey Jacob's eyes. These are the eyes of beauty. These are the eyes of a scorned lover, you know? And she got away with it.
Well, the unwritten rule. God bless that one.
So, yes.
She was certainly a lot more attractive than Edward Kelly,
yes,
though.
Which almost certainly helps.
And a snappier dresser.
And women, of course, don't commit crimes unless driven to it. That's the other thing. Men are naturally bad. Women don't commit crimes unless circumstances force them to.
Well, and Ed had another, quiver in his... with his arrows there, he was crazy.
Yes, and an alcoholic, which, so there's that. So, yes, it's up, but mental health has certainly come a long way.
So you're saying that Edward Kelly had been in and out of mental health facilities before his time in Fremantle Prison?
That's what he said. I mean, it would seem that he said there were some in America he'd been in, mental health facilities there, and elsewhere, which is a little vague, but certainly before he'd arrived.
That'd be pretty much impossible for them to have checked, wouldn't it?
It would be.
Back in those days.
I don't see any reason to really dispute it. I know he's trying to, claim a mental illness justification, but I don't really see why he's certainly acting as if somebody who is... could have been in mental health facilities.
So was there much chance that Edward Kelly was actually going to swing during the trial? Was it a likely outcome?
Well, it was the outcome in one sense, in that he was found guilty and was sentenced. So it was only the clemency through the mental health reports, or the psychiatric reports, that got him off. He could, I would say 50-50, there's always the public. The public attitude can help. So the press entrenchment and the slightly romanticised story would have been to his benefit because it wouldn't have been a popular decision to execute him. That said, had he been executed, of course, we might still be discussing it now, but it would be a less interesting story. It would have been a bloke that shot a cop in a pub and swung for it, and that's the end of the story. Whereas here we have the escapes and the romanticisation of his later life, especially through this one newspaper he kept writing to.
Were they starting to take the death sentence more seriously by 1920? Because it wasn't that long, until 1963,
I think,
Edward Edgar Cook being the last.
It was controversial, controversial, obviously because, as you say, it was only a couple of decades later that we abolished.
Yeah.
It had already moved some time before from being a public... when Perth was set up, executions were still public. The crowd gathered to, shout abuse, basically, at a murderer before he was publicly swung. Shortly after that, executions went private, and that was mainly less to do with, you know, sort of decency, more to do with crowd control. you take the executions behind the walls of Perth Jail, which is now part of the museum complex, of course, then you haven't got a crowd to worry about, because apparently they used to get very agitated, possibly even a little pissed up, you know, to it was an outing.
Well, there'd be there, people
there, wasn't,
that...
there was no Netflix. This was genuinely entertainment. Dickens writes about it in London, and he's horrified by public executions, not because of executions. Dickens is not an abolitionist for execution, but he's horrified by the spectacle and how the crowd behaves. And so it would be unsurprising if a Frio crowd, you know, because that's where the executions were carried out originally, at the Roundhouse.
Right.
There.
So you didn't have the sight of people baying for blood.
Yeah, and I would say, so we've got stories about people showing up there. We don't have seem to have any out of control, but certainly the state decided that rather than take the risk of out of control crowds, they would move execution private. And after that, once you've agreed that execution has to be carried out by the state in private, it's basically a slippery slope to get rid of it. You've already agreed that this isn't something the public wants to see.
Yeah.
This isn't good. I realise the big counterexample is America, but then America is a counterexample to almost everything. So yes. You can't really go, well, it didn't work in America, did it? Nothing is America can be directly compared.
No, they're their own case and example, aren't they? But I guess there was also the prospect of people protesting the execution. I believe when it came to the time when they were executing Midge Guru, that there was a lot of people that were protesting.
There's always been people against executions, and I mean, obviously the execution of Aboriginal people in the early days was controversial for a number of reasons. Mm. You didn't even have to, you know, be some sort of woke lefty to nod. You might just want to go, it's not a good idea to provoke war.
Yes. Yeah. This isn't going to go well for us.
So, yeah, I mean, there are a number of reasons you might want it to have stopped executions of Aboriginal people early. The state still chose us. You just named one of them. Mm-hmm. To carry out some of these executions.
Next station, Perth.
Planet Perth.
So, Edward Kelly, you know, he's looking at this death sentence that he's managed to wrangle himself into mental health care. Was that always going to be forever?
Yes, I think so, because the alternative, if he could ever be declared well again, well, then he should be executed.
Mm.
Effectively, the way you get out of the death penalty was to go, you are permanently and irrevocably damaged through your mental health. Mm. So, in effect, it did. I mean, he was 1928 when he was finally put into Claremont. He lived there until 57 off the top of my head when he died of old age.
Yeah.
Nothing
right.
More interesting than that, as it were. So that is...
Cuts down nearly 30 years.
Nearly 30 years of Claremont. He did write occasional letters, I say. So we do have updates. He wrote occasional complaint letters. Eventually, a Fremantle vicar, I say befriended, I'd use that word carefully, but was in correspondence with him and occasionally took to the state, you know, some of Kelly's complaints about lack of care and the conditions within the asylum.
Yeah.
So we do keep, you know, we keep hearing from him from time to time.
Sticks his head up.
But unfortunately, as some of your readers definitely will know, there's an online newspaper archives called Trove, which is an amazing resource. And they stop just before Kelly dies as an archive, as a resource on Trove, which means that I'm unable to find. I have looked briefly through the scanned, you know, things, but it would require going through every newspaper in 1957, hunting through every story, and that's something I haven't got time
to do
right now, because I wanted to see if there was an obituary or whether his death just passed. It seems to have passed unnoticed, you know, other than presumably one line recorded in a logbook in the asylum, died, you know, Edward Kelly. Don't know. I'd like to know what happened to bodies in those days. Are they confined to Karrakatta still, or is that not right, you know, that
would be buried with other people.
So I'm not quite sure what happens there. So there's another, you know, there's some other angles. which hopefully a listener.
There's not a cemetery on site, or wasn't one on site at Claremont?
I'm not sure. Not sure. I mean, it's still there. The place is still operating. So I don't know.
Wow. So what were the lawful changes pushed through by this case? Like gun legislation, maybe?
No, nothing. Nothing. We
still allowed drunk people to walk into stores and pick themselves up a used gun. For a little while after that.
Well, for some time, I would imagine. Obviously, we just had a more recent clampdown on that people with domestic violence accusations can no longer have it, which seems perfectly reasonable. It might not again to an American, but it seems perfectly reasonable to those of us in Western Australia.
Seems kind of obvious, doesn't it?
I can tell you that the second-hand dealer...
One Ernst Ruttle.
Ernst Ruttle, that's right, yes, Ernst Ruttle. 2 years afterwards, sold a gun to somebody who went and shot somebody else within hours of having purchased it. So this man did not learn his own lesson for not selling guns to people who were about to go off and shoot other people.
Yes, clearly no cooling off period in those days.
No, and he was the place you would go if you wanted to find stolen goods as well. So if there was a burglary in Mount Lawley, you went to Ernest Ruttle and went, hand it over, Ernest. Hand it over now.
Wow.
So...
Had quite a history before it was Wellington Surplus.
He certainly did. Also, he himself, whilst demonstrating definitely, an automatic pistol in the mid-30s, managed to shoot himself in the arm whilst demonstrating an automatic pistol to a prospective purchaser. So he wasn't even good at handling his own guns that he was handing off to drunk people in the street, basically, around Wellington Street.
And Ernest Ruttle continued trading and selling
guns. There doesn't seem to be any
blowback whatsoever.
None. Maybe the cops told him off, had a private word with him, but that's just not recorded. But he certainly didn't, I'm not even sure you'd had a license to sell guns. I'm not sure what the exact situation would have been in 1920s. But he certainly was still selling guns 10 years later when he's shooting himself in the arm with them.
Yeah.
So, no, there were no changes. You would have thought that, a cooling-off period, if drunk people want a gun, you go, no, come back tomorrow, would have been a sensible...
You'd think.
But it doesn't seem to have occurred to anyone at the time.
Nothing. Wow. We spoke a little bit about Claremont Hospital and the role that it played in this case. Do you know much about all the escapes that he did? I mean, we mentioned the one that he...
Well, there's two. He escaped within a year of being there in 1929.
Yep.
And that's the one where he claims to have been to the Royal Show
dressed as a woman. Yep.
And also, he also claimed that three little girls kept bringing him food, although not even the Mirror, who was his backer, about this time, believed that story. That just seems romantic. He's hiding out in the woods and three little girls find him hiding out in the woods and keep bringing him food. So he then wrote a letter to the Mirror saying that if they had a photographer ready, he would be, at 9 a.m. on the dot at the gate for readmission to the asylum. And they did indeed. So there is a very famous photograph at the front page of the Mirror in 1929 of a journalist and taken by the photographer for the Mirror of Edward Kelly and this journalist, looking like their best chums as he's escorting him back. So the newspaper gets a coup, gets the exclusive. But in exchange, it builds up Edward Kelly. It makes him a heroic figure who not only escaped, but voluntarily returned, to the asylum in exchange for a media exclusive.
How did the public react to that sort of escape? Because, it certainly augurs towards an opinion that perhaps he's not as, well...
Not as mad as he thinks he is.
Not as ill as he was making out.
Well, it's hard to know what the public could have said. You could scurry through somebody's diary or see if there were any angry letters.
So we're lumped with the media understanding of it.
But given that the Mirror kept pushing his case for a decade or more... every now and again a new letter would be written to the Mirror and they would run it in full, unedited, on the front page. So they kept pushing him. You'd suspect that if their readers didn't like it, they would have stopped. So it does imply that, at least in the Mirror's eyes, the public had an appetite four stories. And he did escape again in 36, so that is 7-8 years after he
Another
was
jaunt to the Royal Show, was it, or...?
No, we don't know much this time, I don't think. He just escaped, and he again was just... There's no account of his capture. There's just a newspaper note saying he's back behind, you know, bars, as it were, in the mental asylum rather than the... after a few days. But they did put out, you know, warnings, and people... There's a hint that some people didn't like some of the things, because... the newspapers reported that women were a little nervous in the local neighbourhood, knowing that an escaped lunatic, you know, was at large. So,
was he considered to be dangerous as such?
Well, he himself, in a letter to the Mirror, said, "I'm not dangerous as long as I stay off the grog." And obviously, I've been off the grog for some time now because I've been banged up for 8 years where there is no grog. Mm. So that was his, you know, thing. So, but he's put in a mental asylum for life because he was a dangerous person. So you would think that some danger, but no, there doesn't seem to be any accounts of him doing anything bad on either of the two jaunts, which again, of course, leads to this, you know, reputation of the heroic figure. Not only does he escape, does he not need to go in disguise to the Royal Show?
But what a good guy.
But even voluntarily, you know, at least on one occasion, the second time, we just know he's back there again. It doesn't, newspapers and accounts, unfortunately, don't reveal how he got back again.
It's amazing how sympathetic the media was in those days to somebody that, well, had committed such a crime. You mentioned before Audrey Jacob.
And the original Ned Kelly.
You know, it was able to wiggle out of a fully witnessed crime.
Yeah, I think it's luck of the draw to one extent. You know, obviously, if you're charming or beautiful, it's going to help your case. Not everybody criminal gets this privilege. Some criminals are considered disgusting by the public at the time and remain that reputation. They're almost the ones we never hear of because they're fairly ordinary criminals. They did their crime, they either got executed or banged up, and that's the end of the story. It's the ones that somehow get romantic attachments. And I do think that his name and the fact that he was Irish, or at least of Irish descent and American Irish, may have contributed to some of the romanticization.
So why did he turn himself in again? I mean, he was a sailor. He knew, you know, how to get onto the ports and get himself out of town. Why did he hang around?
He was fairly distinctive, as we've established. Although, how distinctive compared to another sailor, I couldn't tell you without a lineup of 7 equivalent sailors. Where do you go? I mean, you could smuggle yourself onto a ship. He would have had no money.
Yeah.
Unless he did another robbery, you know, to get money, which is possible, but then that would always, you know, risk triggering immediate attention and getting yourself back. And this time, you might end up in Frio jail rather than, sort of Claremont.
But he was certainly playing with fire, escaping and then returning, wasn't he?
He was, but I mean, I'm unable to tell you again. You'd require the logbooks of the asylum to see if any punishment, whether he had to go to solitary or had privileges withdrawn for these. But the newspapers certainly didn't make it out to be some horrendous offence, just a jaunt. But don't forget, one of these is literally just a year or two after he has murdered the police, and the newspapers are making this escape out to be a jaunt.
You cannot see that happening now.
You cannot.
You just can't imagine the public reacting well to that. You certainly can't imagine the media being part of it.
No, it's just, it is, again, but this is why we're discussing.
Yeah.
It's because it is not like, you know, how we would react today. It's a different case. Today, if somebody, a cop murderer was out and he was shot down by the cops, you know, on the street, very few people would start asking questions about, was that necessary?
Yeah. It's, well, it is even, just still now, just amazing that Ed was able to sidestep this one. I thought Audrey was an interesting case, but this one...
Well, mate. Audrey got away with it, of course, if you are to believe, you know, the more modern versions of it. But I don't know. I think it's luck. Something about him, his ability to write interesting letters, his ability to get some kind of relationship going with at least one journalist on one newspaper who then decided that this was going to be, you know, a way of getting exclusives for the newspaper. So there's commercial interests. This is not just...
Yeah, and that's the bit that's troubling the whole way along, is how much that commercial interest was, just that. It has no interest or no interplay in justice. It's just about the newspaper getting more newspapers sold.
As is Audrey Jacobs' story.
Yeah.
Because I imagine that if you ran a good headline... especially there's one famous one with just the eyes of her cut out on the front page, with just the eyes, you know, of, I can't remember the exact headline, but it's just the eyes of Audrey Jacob, I believe, just the, you know, just a huge full page width, just the eyes, slit, cut out, put there. And obviously, famously, if you put a picture of Princess Diana on any magazine, it sold 10 times more copies than a magazine next to it that didn't have a picture. There's an interest there too. When Audrey Jacob's trial is the hot story, you put an Audrey Jacob story on the front, you're going to, if you start damning her, ooh, and the public's decided that she's the good one, perhaps you don't want to do that. So it just feeds back into itself. Newspapers want to sell newspapers. The public is now reading positive stories about Audrey Jacob. It's not going to end up in a conviction at the end of the day.
Well, it's a personal note to self if things go bad.
Try to be charming to a newspaper man.
Without any doubt, mate, that is certainly where I'm going to be heading. A big thank you to Eddie Marcus for joining us on Planet Perth. My name is Jeff Bullen and I'm your host. Thanks to assistant producer Siobhan Dale and executive producer Danielle Raphael, who edits this podcast. Our theme music is Can't Blame the City by local band The Mackerels, with artwork by Hannah Coakley. If you'd like to get in touch with an interesting story for us to cover, you can reach us at planetperth@rtrfm.com.au. Next time, we're taking a look at Perth's dark political history and one of its infamous figures, Jack Van Tongeren.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.